detail all the water vapor in the atmosphere. So you got to compare H2O without respect to whether it's liquid or gas. And when you do that, well, rather than try to give you numbers of tons or something that nobody would understand because the numbers are too big, let me imagine, since Venus and the Earth are about the same size, this is a direct comparison, imagine that I can wave a magic wand and make all the water vapor on Venus turn into liquid, never mind how I do this, you know, somehow I turn it into liquid, and make it rain out uniformly all over the planet, okay? And I make the planet absolutely smooth like a billiard ball. I push all the mountains into the valley, so you have an average depth of water all over the planet. If I tell you what that depth is, it expresses how much water Venus has. If you can do that with the Earth, of course, it has mostly rained out. It is sitting around as a liquid. So if you smooth out all the topographic depressions and elevations on the Earth, you would have about 2 miles worth of water, 2 miles deep all over the Earth. And of course, you probably do, right? That is the average depth of the ocean. So a first approximation, the Earth is covered by water, and it averages 2 miles deep. On Venus, it would be about 4 inches deep. So you see, Venus has lost almost all its water, or Venus formed with much, much less water. Millions of times less water. Thousands of times less water than the Earth. And the question is why? We still are not fully sure we know the answer. There is still the argument going on between those who think that Venus formed out of material with less water than the Earth, and those who think that it once had it and lost it. The argument for the people who say it formed out of material that was different from the Earth is a very convincing one. And that is, terrestrial planets are made only of materials which were solid at the time those planets formed, at their distance from the Sun. Venus was closer to the Sun than the Earth is, therefore it was hotter, therefore you could easily believe there was less water. As a matter of fact, if you look at the materials the planets are made of, if you look at the abundance of different kinds of atoms in the universe as a whole, and you say, well, here's the solar system forming 4.5 billion years ago out of a big cloud of gas that is basically made of this ordinary, normal cosmic abundance. Well, remove the hydrogen, remove the helium, remove the neon, remove everything that would have been a gas. Consider things that might have been solid. Well, water would have been if it was cold enough, right? Out where Jupiter is, the water was solid. And so Jupiter has moons that are made mostly not of rock, but of water. The point I'm trying to make is that water, the atoms that make up water, are about 3 times as abundant as the atoms that make up rock. The atoms that make up water are oxygen plus hydrogen, but it's the oxygen that dominates. You know, there's enough hydrogen to go around. So you've got to consider the oxygen. The atoms that make up rock are silicon, and again, oxygen, but it's the silicon that dominates because there's more than enough oxygen to go around. And the silicates that make up the rock should be about 1/3 as abundant as the water. In other words, if the Earth had all the water that's coming to it, this planet should be 3/4 water. You say, well, it is 3/4 water. No, that's on the surface. Okay, the depth of the ocean is negligible. The body of the Earth is made of rock, not of frozen water. You head to Jupiter, and I will show you pictures of worlds that are made mostly of water. Callisto is basically a 3,000-mile snowball with a little bit of rock, but it's 3-to-1 water. So it's believable that since the Earth lost most of its water, that Venus would have lost even more. On the other hand, Venus, if it lost its water, how would it have happened? Water, remember, would have been a vapor. The Sun shines on that vapor. Ultraviolet light from the Sun breaks the water molecules into the hydrogen and oxygen. The hydrogen, being too light for Venus to hold, escapes into space. You lose a whole planetful of water that way, as far as the hydrogen is concerned. But what do you do with the oxygen? That is the problem. When you calculate it, you find that in order... See, the oxygen cannot be lost into space. It's too heavy. Venus' gravity would hold it. Even at Venus' temperature, it would hold it. And so the only way you can do it is by saying the oxygen attacks the surface, it oxidizes the surface rocks and soil. The planet rusted to death. Mars pretty much did that. But in the case of Venus, you thought, well, that's not fair, because Mars outgassed very, very much less gas than either Venus or Earth. But if you look at Venus and you calculate how much oxidation would it require to take up all the oxygen that is present in an Earth ocean full of water, you would have to oxidize the entire surface, every last cubic millimeter of it, to a depth of 2 miles. This is an example of something we very often do in science. It's a good way to shoot down theories or confirm them. You don't just say, oh, it sounds plausible. Yeah, that could happen. You look at the numbers. You see if the numbers come out right. And most people just don't think it is numerically reasonable that obviously you wouldn't have had 100% efficient oxidation. So you're talking about many more than 2 miles. Most people just cannot believe that the surface could get turned over so much that it gets oxidized to a depth of many miles, particularly since radar observations of Venus from the Earth and from Pioneer Venus Orbiter seem to be showing features that are very, very old, billions of years old, namely meteorite impact craters. And, you know, how come they're still there if the surface has been turned over and got rid of all that water? But there is more to it than that. And the biggest discovery from Pioneer Venus, which I might as well tell you about since we've gotten on the subject, I had it planned for a little bit later on, but it doesn't matter. I mean, there's no major slide for this or anything. The greatest discovery about Pioneer Venus was about the argon in Venus's atmosphere. Now, I've got to do some explanation here. Argon is a gas. It is a so-called noble gas. The noble gases are the ones that used to be called inert gases, and many of you who had chemistry more than about 20 years ago learned them that way. They are helium, and then neon, argon, krypton, and so on. And those were called inert gases because the chemists believed that under no circumstances ever would they undergo chemical reactions. Well, it has since turned out that a few of them, under extreme contrived circumstances that happen only in the laboratory and would not happen in nature, can with great difficulty be forced to make simple compounds. And the chemists were so puristic about it that they decided to rename them and not call them inert gases anymore. Now, this is ridiculous because there are a lot of terms in chemistry that, taken literally, are a lot more meaningless than inert gases would have been. For example, organic chemicals, most of which have nothing whatever to do with living organisms. But they're named that because they are the class that includes what living organisms are made of, and once upon a time we thought that they were nothing but that class. But, we know for over a century that wasn't true. Nevertheless, we're stuck with this name change, and so they decided to call them noble gases. The point is that under natural conditions, noble gases do not undergo chemical reactions. So, the fact that you have so very, very few noble gases in the atmosphere, for example, the Earth, is the best proof that I can give you that our primeval atmosphere has been essentially lost. Very small amounts of them were physically trapped, I mean just trapped in the molecular structure of substances underground, but most of our noble gases are simply boiled off into space. We have a tiny, tiny amount of noble gases left. And you say that are left over from the primeval atmosphere, but it's way under one part per million of the Earth's present-day atmosphere, virtually all of which is due to outgassing. You say, now wait a minute, how can you say that? How do you know? Here's an atom of gas, it's just sitting there, dumb, you know, it can't even tell its own name. How do you know whether that is left over from the primeval atmosphere 4.5 billion years ago, or got outgassed from some natural gas field 5 days ago? And the answer is, in the case of argon, you can do it really nicely. You don't know why yet, but you are going to find out. There are two kinds of argon. Let's see if you're still paying attention. There are two kinds of argon. Argon is not a common substance in the universe. It is a rather rare substance. There's far more neon than argon, for example. That's in the universe. In the Earth's atmosphere, however, argon is so common that it is the third most abundant gas in the Earth's atmosphere. After the nitrogen and the oxygen, 1% of the Earth's atmosphere is made up of argon. And it's so rare in the universe that we have no neon, for example. Probably no neon. So where did the argon come from? Answer, it was produced by radioactive decay of radioactive potassium in the rocks of the Earth. Radioactive means that the substance, given enough time, and depending on the substance, enough time to be a tiny fraction of a second or tens of billions of years, or anything in between, given enough time, it changes spontaneously into a different kind of material. Well, one of the major radioactive substances in the Earth's rock is potassium 40, which is a type of potassium that is radioactive and, given enough time, billions of years in this case, changes spontaneously into argon 40. And the point is that argon is a gas. And so it escapes from the rock, and actually so much of this has happened that, and argon is a heavy gas. We don't lose it gravitationally. So once it escapes, it stays there. And it has now accumulated from all the radioactive decay of all the potassium 40 over geologic time to the point where it's 1% of the Earth's atmosphere. But that's argon 40. In the universe as a whole, there is very little argon, but such argon as there is almost entirely a lighter form of argon, which is called argon 36. The numbers 36 and 40 refer to how heavy the atom is. They're both argon, but one of them is heavier than the other. And roughly they mean that they are respectively 36 times as heavy and 40 times as heavy as hydrogen atom. It's a little more complex than that, but that'll do for tonight. So, if you see an argon 36 atom in the Earth's atmosphere, it was not produced by radioactive decay. It is therefore left over from the primeval atmosphere. If you see an argon 40 atom in the Earth's atmosphere, it was almost certainly not part of the primeval atmosphere because almost all the argon that was in that was 36. Rather, the argon 40 atom came from radioactive decay. Everybody with me at this point? Please, if you're not, say so, because I don't want to waste your time and mine, you know, going through a lot of stuff you don't understand. This is the biggest discovery from Pioneer Venus on which you citizens and taxpayers invested almost 5% of your chewing gum experiences during the expenditure during the same time. So I want you to know what you got for your money. Okay, everybody happy with this? Okay. Well, on Earth, there is about 1/300 as much argon 36, which remembers left over from the primeval atmosphere, as there is argon 40, which was generated by radioactive decay. Okay? On Venus. Now remember, Venus has just about as much carbon dioxide as the Earth has outgassed. I'm sorry, I haven't told you that yet, but it does. Venus has the kind of atmosphere the Earth ought to have if a weird thing, which I'll tell you about in a moment after I get through this argon thing, hadn't happened and gotten rid of our carbon dioxide for us. Venus has just about the same amount of carbon dioxide as the Earth has, just about the same amount of nitrogen. If it had photosynthesis, it would have just about the same amount of oxygen as the Earth does. It's got just about the same amount of radioactively produced argon, the argon-40, as the Earth has, and that's one of the reasons why I told you that we don't think Venus is really tremendously more geologically active than the Earth, because radioactive heat is what drives geologic activity, like volcanoes and earthquakes and so forth. And so, if the amount of radioactivity that's produced the argon is the same as Venus, you know, the amount of other kinds of radioactivity is probably the same, too. So, what you've got on Venus is basically, aside from the water, an Earth-type atmosphere. Except that, in addition to the argon-40, which is present in about the same amount as it is in the atmosphere of the Earth, there is 300 times as much argon-36 in the atmosphere of Venus as there is on the Earth. Or to put it another way, remember how I told you there's only 1/300th as much 36 as 40 in the Earth's atmosphere? There is almost as much 36 as 40 in the atmosphere of Venus. There's an Earth atmosphere worth of argon 40 and just about that amount again of argon 36. You can go through the same kind of argument with isotopes. Isotopes means the difference between, for example, 36 and 40, the heavy atoms and the light atoms of a given kind of element, of neon and a krypton, and you find that Venus has the same excess of primeval neon and primeval krypton and probably of primeval helium, but in that case you can't tell, because radioactively derived helium on the Earth, and that's where virtually all the helium in the Earth's atmosphere comes from, is the same kind of helium as is most common in the universe. But it looks as though Venus has retained 300 times as much of its primeval atmosphere as the Earth has. Now, actually, with retrospect, we realized we were really dumb, because 3 years ago, we found out the other end of that same trend on Mars. Mars has only a tenth as much primeval atmosphere relative to outgas atmosphere as Earth does. In other words, there is only 1/3,000th as much argon-36 as argon-40 on Mars. 1/300th as much on Venus and about the same amount. I'm sorry, 1/300th as much on Earth and about the same amount on Venus. So, in case of Mars, we discovered that and everybody said, yes, Earth's great. So they didn't want to give up the idea that the three planets had formed out of more or less the same kind of material. And so, various ad hoc hypotheses which sounded good at the time were dreamed up to get rid of the argon-36 and the primeval krypton and so forth on Mars. It turns out that there are all kinds of mechanisms that you can dream up to get rid of some gas from a planet's atmosphere through its geologic history. But there just are very few mechanisms, there are no reasonable mechanisms, to add large amounts. Remember, we're talking about 300 times too much of some gas to a planet's atmosphere during its geologic history. So, it looks as though, at least with respect to noble gases, Venus may have formed from material that was different from the Earth and from Mars. Or, somehow, it's managed to retain more. And either of those is very, very hard. And you see, you've got this progression from Venus to Earth to Mars as you go outward from the Sun. I guess I should have explained. Not everybody knows this, of course. Venus is closer to the Sun than we are, and Mars is farther from the Sun than we are. So there's a progression, Venus, Earth, Mars. And in that progression, you have, as you get farther from the Sun, where it gets colder, where you would think the gas would be less and less driven off if there were no differences, instead you find you get less and less gas. And that is causing people who theorize about the origins of the solar system in its early history to just go back to square one in many cases and just start all over. Remember, please, it's not a matter of all gases become more abundant as you move in toward the Sun. It's just these noble gases, the primeval atmosphere constituents. The outgassing products are the same. Venus, Earth, and Mars have the same ratios of abundances of the various outgassing products, aside from this weird thing about the water on Venus, which I've got to get to next. I wish you could tell the answer. I don't know the answer. It may very well be significant portions of the processes that led to the formation of the planet, and particularly that got rid of the primeval gases, the noble gases, happened before there was a sun. Or at least before the sun had turned off, before the sun had gotten hot. And if you consider a cold, relatively cold, rotating cloud of gas and dust, which is what we think the solar system formed from, except the picture had always been one cold, hot in the center, right from the very beginning. In other words, there's a big bright thing in the sun there in the center. If you imagine it was cold instead, you can picture processes by which gases would be selectively retained as you go from the outside in. See, it's not necessarily hottest at the center. It could be hottest from the outside, where materials, for example, are treating more rapidly. This is just our brain. We don't know at the moment. But we never would have known there was something to know if we hadn't gone to Venus and made this truly remarkable discovery. It sounds really esoteric, I realize. You know, you appear on these radio talk shows, and of course they always have this question, how do you justify the expenditure of the money? You know, they never ask this of anybody except space exploration enthusiasts. We spend more money every year on spectator sports than we do on NASA. And I have never heard a baseball player interviewed and demand to justify the amount of money we spend on spectator sports. When it comes to exploring the universe, all of a sudden we seriously can't afford it. We have to justify every single expenditure over and over again. Well, for Voyager, it's very easy. You know, people say, I appear on a talk show, and the interviewer says, you know, why should people be interested in this kind of stuff? I pull out these spectacular pictures of Io with the volcanoes going off and erupting plumes 200 miles high, and the great red spot, and hurricanes 2.5 times the diameter of the Earth on Jupiter. And I say, you know, these are spectacular pictures. That they can relate to. When I tell them, do you realize there's 10 times as much primeval argon as Venus is on Earth? You know, unless they have some idea of the significance of that. Because they all want it in two sentences, you know. And you can't explain it in two sentences. You can explain it, you can't give the background, you know. And it's for that reason, I think Pioneer Venus got very, very little coverage in the media. And I think it's a shame. I predicted ahead of time. Those of you who were here for my last lecture series, remember I said this. This is going to be the most underreported planetary mission in history. And it has turned out, at least U.S., and it has turned out to be so. But it made a discovery which is probably among, oh, let's say the 10 most important in history for our understanding of how this solar system of ours got to be here in the first place. I wish I could tell you more about the final resolution, you know, what that clue is telling. What we found out is we were very, very wrong. Okay, that was an extremely long answer to a very short question, mainly because I got into another entire topic, which I would have gotten into anyway later in the lecture. So, you know, please don't assume that every question that you ask is going to get half an hour's worth. But this was the big, you know, this was worth it. This is just using up the time for it. But I've still got one loose end, and that is what happened to water on Venus. What happened to carbon dioxide on Earth? where the argon is relevant to water on Venus is just, if you go to the assumption that Venus formed out of material that was different from the Earth as far as noble gases go, maybe you can go to the assumption it was different as far as water was, too. But remember, you've got to produce the same amount of carbon dioxide, of nitrogen, of radioactive substances, and therefore of argon-40. So it's going to be really tough. It's going to be very, very non-obvious. One thing I can tell you, though, the whole assumption probably never had very much validity. It's the simplest one to make. And in science, you like to stick with simple assumptions until you're driven by the evidence to depart from them. That is a rule of procedure, it's not a scientific law at all. It's a rule of procedure called Occam's razor, which has turned out to be very useful. And that's its only justification. It turns out to be a good shortcut method to eventually find the answer. assume things are simple until you're driven by the evidence other way around. And the simplest assumption is all the terrestrial planets formed out of the same kind of material. But we've got samples of terrestrial planet material dating unchanged from the origin of the solar system, 4.5 billion years ago. They are the meteorites. And when we study the amounts, the tiny amounts of gases that are trapped in meteorites, we find they are by no means all the same. So maybe we should have seen this coming. But, you know, everybody has 20/20 hindsight. I mean, it's always easier to argue we should have seen it when you know the answer. The carbon dioxide on Earth, well, because the temperatures on this planet are what they are, a strange thing happened, and that is what should have been the major atmospheric constituent, the water vapor, liquefied. That itself is not the answer. Yes, the liquid oceans can dissolve a little bit of carbon dioxide, but very, very little. However, a strange thing then happened in those oceans, the development of a peculiar chemical phenomenon known as life. And that happened, we now know, at least 3.8 billion years ago. In fact, it was earlier than that. Because the very oldest rocks on Earth, which are 3 billion 800 million years old, they're from Greenland, were found, this was announced last week, to contain organic material from whose chemistry we can show that it was produced by living things. And these are the oldest rocks on Earth. The formation of life on this planet must have been a remarkably rapid process. Not too many hundreds of millions of years before that, the entire Earth was molten. So, you know, the life obviously didn't form until the Earth had cooled, had solidified. And it seems to have happened very, very fast. Which makes it all the more puzzling that we seem to be having so much trouble finding life elsewhere in the solar system. If it was so easy for it to form here, you know, why hasn't it been easy elsewhere? Well, of course, maybe it was. Maybe there is life on Mars. We don't know this day. Life on Titan seems to have been ruled out. But more on that later. Anyway, and Jupiter is still a possibility, although not a good one. And Saturn is a possibility, although not a good one. But in any case, life developed. Now, you've got to realize this is very primitive. These are very primitive organisms. Throughout most of the history of this life on Earth, the temperature was just below the boiling point of water. And that seems to have precluded, so this is a recent discovery, about 2 years old. And that seems to have precluded the development of complex forms of life, such as cockroaches, pine trees, and us. About 800 million years ago, the temperature fell suddenly. We're not entirely sure why. It may have had something to do with the fact that photosynthesis had developed, finally. And all of a sudden, now photosynthesis is a much better way of generating energy than anything else that had been popular up to that time, for example, fermentation. But the problem with photosynthesis is it produces enormous quantities of a highly toxic, very, very reactive, and therefore very, very dangerous chemical, oxygen, which is released by the photosynthetic organism as a waste product. Whereas fermentation, as we all know, produces a substance that is not only not dangerous, but is necessary to life. Well, in the case of photosynthesis, the sudden development of photosynthesis, and it was sudden evolutionarily because these organisms that had it were so successful. They were so much more energetic than everybody else that they just, you know, wham, took over the ecology. But they very nearly destroyed all life on Earth in the process. It was the greatest ecological catastrophe in the history of the Earth. It very nearly destroyed life on this planet. Oxygen is terribly poisonous. You don't realize that. Of course, organisms like ourselves couldn't exist if it were not for the even greater amounts of energy that we can obtain by oxidizing substances using this poisonous stuff for our own purposes, you see. But even organisms like us that need it, evolution has had to develop for us elaborate chemical defense mechanisms in our cells to get rid of the stuff or at least immobilize it before it's been around very long. You are living within a hair's breadth of chemical disaster at all times. Don't worry about it. I mean, these mechanisms are very well developed by now. But you'd be amazed how fine the line is between getting the energy you need to live from oxidation and being destroyed by that same oxidation. Well, in any case, it seems suspicious. Photosynthesis seems to have developed about 800 million years, a little bit more ago. And so all of a sudden you get oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. There may have been, up to that point, trace amounts of ammonia and methane, both of which are tremendously good greenhouses. Okay? And the oxygen immediately destroyed them. Oxygen oxidizes methane to carbon dioxide, and it oxidizes ammonia to nitrogen. And it's just at that time, just after photosynthesis developed, that the temperature suddenly plummets from near the boiling point of water where it had been through most of the history of Europe, not all, just to complicate things even further. There have been ice ages during that period, most of which was near the boiling point of water. And we don't understand that one at all. But, it just means there were a lot of climatic change, a lot of ups and downs. But the result was the temperature fell, and suddenly, 200 million years later, the beginning of the Cambrian, you have this explosion in the fossil record. Every single major phylum of animals and plants suddenly appears, except the chordates, and the chordates are there by the end of the Cambrian, 100 million years later. So you see, again, when conditions are right, life develops explosively. Well, long before that, these organisms, which were simple, single-celled animals and plants, or things that were so simple you can't even tell them animals or plants. You know, there are five kingdoms now in biology. Animals, plants, huh, what, and how's that? There are five kingdoms. These organisms had zero interest in planetary geochemistry. You gotta realize, they were dumb, all right? And they were nice, but they were dumb. However, they had a great deal of interest in not being eaten by other little single-celled organisms. And in order to protect them from such a horrible fate, evolution developed a number of neat defense mechanisms, one of which, and this came in at least 3 billion years ago, was the institution of the shell. Now, I'm not talking about clam shells and snail shells. I'm talking now. I mean, they came along later, too, of course. But I am talking about individual cells that have shells within their structure. And to this day, the majority of the shell-bearing organisms on the Earth are that way. Foraminifera, radiolaria, diatoms, calcareous algae, all kinds of things. What are shells made of? Answer, a whole bunch of different things, about a dozen in all. But by far the most popular substance is calcium carbonate. How do these organisms produce calcium carbonate? Answer, they combine calcium salt dissolved in the water, having been leached out of the oceans by the rivers, with carbon dioxide dissolved in the water from the atmosphere. For at least 3 billion years, these organisms have been removing carbon dioxide from the oceans and therefore from the atmosphere, because more just gets absorbed by the oceans in the atmosphere after they do this, and turning it into their shells. And it works. And they live long, happy, healthy lives, and have lots of parties, and have lots of little foraminifera, radiolaria, diatoms, calcareous algae, and so forth. I guess I shouldn't say foraminifera, those are not calcium carbonate, but, you know, all the others. And finally, at the end of their long, happy, healthy, productive lives, they die, all their relatives sitting around their bedside, and the shells sink down to the bottom, and they pile up, and they pile up, and they pile up, until they can be miles in thickness and form the rock limestone, which is the most common rock at the surface of the Earth today. Or I should say, limestone plus sedimentary rock, in which the cement is calcium carbonate, is the most common. That has gone on for 3 billion years, and if you calculate the amount of carbon dioxide that is tied up chemically in the limestone and the other carbonate rocks of the Earth, it is almost exactly equal to the amount that we see as a gas in the atmosphere of Venus. So you see, it is Venus and not the Earth that is the normal one, at least as far as the carbon dioxide goes. If life had not developed in the oceans of the Earth, the same thing would have happened. There are non-living chemical processes which will combine the calcium salts with the carbon dioxide and produce calcium carbonate. They take longer, but, you know, nature has the time. So I don't want you to get the idea that we would have a Venus-type atmosphere if we didn't have life. That is not true. But we would have a Venus-type atmosphere if our water were not liquid. And it was a very close thing. What happened was, because we had liquid water, the carbonate formed, and the carbon dioxide did not pile up in the atmosphere. On Venus, suppose it had been a little warmer, then the water would have remained a vapor, and it would have piled up in the atmosphere, and the carbon dioxide would have piled up in the atmosphere, and both water vapor and carbon dioxide are very good greenhouses, and so they would have made it hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and the Earth never would have had liquid oceans. It was a very close thing. If the Earth had formed just 5% closer to the Sun, we would have had an atmosphere like Venus. And if the Earth had formed 2% farther out from the Sun, then at the time of that temperature fall, 800 million years ago, the entire Earth's oceans would have frozen, And thereafter, since ice reflects sunlight into space better than rock does, and therefore makes the planet colder, the Earth would have been locked in the grip of a permanent global ice age to this day. Of course, I'm not saying that there are not kinds of life other than Earth-type life. But that's another story for another time. Any questions? That's the end of that whole chemical topic. What the air is made of topic. Yeah. No. All this has nothing to do with the origin of the universe, which happened at least 15 billion years earlier than the origin of the solar system. By the way, I will show you a world locked in the grip of a permanent global ice age. I will show you a world where it happened. Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. Any other questions? No. I think we know so little about it. I think we know so little about it that we can't even put a probability on it. This is not a question session. This is just, you know, the end of a section. I'll leave another slide eventually. Honestly, I will. I have other slides in the tray, believe it or not. You might like to see them. But this just seemed like a reasonable place to ask for any questions you might have. No, I'm not saying that I think Earth-type life is rare. I'm saying that we are so ignorant that we can't even put a probability on it. The standard argument goes, suppose Earth-type life is so rare that only one star in a million has an Earth-type planet with Earth-type life. There are still so many stars in our galaxy that in this galaxy alone, there are 250,000 such stars. Yeah, fine. So what? Suppose only one planet in a trillion has it. We don't know. One in a million happens to be a standard English phrase. You know, it has no scientific significance. I'm saying we don't know. I will be very surprised, however, if either Earth-type planets or Earth-type life turns out to be common. And the reason I say that is I am extremely impressed with the way we've learned, as we've gone out into the solar system and found out what it's really like as opposed to what we thought it was like back when we didn't know. Every single world insists on being completely different from all the rest. Now, if nature can produce that much variety in relatively simple systems, geologic and meteorologic systems, how much more variety is nature going to be capable of when you get into really complex systems where you can therefore have much more scope for variety, namely biological? My suspicion is only suspicion. You know, I could turn out to be very wrong. I'm going beyond science now. I'm just giving you speculation, but it's informed speculation based on what we've seen so far. My suspicion is it will turn out that life is very common and that it has tremendous variety and very little of it is anything like us. Most science fiction writers haven't come to grip with that kind of thing. For example, I have seen any number of critics praise the bar scene in Star Wars. Because the other organisms don't look like people, and they don't talk like people, but they talk. They communicate the same way. They evidently have the same level of intelligence, or a little lower. You know, all the action in that film is from people, in fact, from white males. You know, this is the Galactic Empire. I'm sorry, these are the rebels, but still. You know, all these organisms are sitting around in the same atmosphere, in the same gravity, apparently getting drunk on the same substance, listening to the same music, and talking to each other through interpreters. I'm sorry, I don't believe it. For one thing, if there is life elsewhere in the universe, in particular if there's intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, it is almost certainly more advanced than we are. I shouldn't say that if there's life elsewhere in the universe. There is probably much less advanced life than we, and probably much more advanced as well. I'd like to point out that although there is nothing particularly special about our place in space, you know, we got burned repeatedly by making that assumption. There's something special about us. You know, first we were the center of the universe, then at least our solar system was the center of the universe, then at least we were the center of the galaxy, then at least we had the biggest galaxy, and, you know, now we know none of those are true. But we got burned repeatedly by doing that, but although there's nothing special about our place in space, there is something very special about our place in time. Only in the last 0.1% of the entire history of the Earth has there been intelligent life on this planet. Either intelligent life is a very short-lived phenomenon, a possibility which I'm sorry to say we can't rule out. You know, maybe it's an evolutionary mistake. Maybe, for example, an intelligent species automatically develops nuclear warfare, you know, and wipes itself out. I would like to think that's not true, but that doesn't prove it's not true. But either that, or we must be among the youngest intelligent species in this galaxy, or in the universe. It has taken only 600 million years, which is less than 1/8 of the history of the Earth, to go all the way from the beginning of the Cambrian, when the most advanced organism was a worm, all the way up to that pinnacle of evolution, me. Suppose you go to a star that is only 10% older than the Sun. That star is already farther ahead of us than we are from the beginning of the Cambrian. And we know stars that are 3 times the age of the Sun. Those stars, however, may not have planets. How do we search that planet? Because they formed when the universe was much poorer in the kinds of atoms that are made of Earth-type planets that it is now. So I can't get into that. Okay, let's go on to another subject. We've got 10 minutes left. This is something that we saw. Remember we were talking about circulation in the atmosphere of Venus way back when? This is something that has been seen dimly from the Earth in ultraviolet photographs and can be seen very well in some of the Mariner 10 images, and that is a feature that's shaped like a Y. And the picture that we had after Mariner 10 was that this Y formed when a blob, one of those dark blobs that you saw moving around in the picture, in the pictures before, hits the edge of the eye of Venus and splits into two, and therefore suddenly makes this circulation around the eye of Venus that is here all the time visible. Well, as we shall see from Pioneer 10, it ain't that simple. By the way, I should go back to this last picture for one final note, and that is that this these 300-mile-an-hour winds that we have, 250-300-mile-an-hour winds in the upper cloud layer, and the atmospheric regions around them, are often referred to as the four-day circulation, because it takes only 4 Earth days for the winds to blow a feature completely around the planet. And remember, the surface down there, down about 50 miles below, is make that 50 kilometers below, about 30 miles below, is turning around once every 243 Earth days. Venus has the slowest rotation of any body that we know in the solar system. It's the only planet we know whose day is longer than its year. It takes 225 Earth days to go around the Sun. It takes 243 Earth days to turn around once on its axis. And that means that a Venus day is 1.08 Venus years long. Furthermore, Venus rotates in the wrong direction. If you can see the Sun through the clouds, which it turns out you cannot, by the way, I told you last year you can. We now know better. You can't. Which makes the shadows that appear in the Venera 9 and 10 pictures all that much harder to understand. But you can, at least at the landing site of the Pioneer Venus probe, and there were 4 of those. If you could see the Sun through the clouds, it would rise in the west and set in the east, 56 Earth days later. Okay, let me tell you about the Pioneer Venus mission. I did a lot of this last year, so I'll go through it real fast. There were 2 spacecraft, the multi-probe Pioneer Venus 2, which you see in the background, the orbiter Pioneer Venus 1, which you see in the foreground. As the name implies, the orbiter, well, this is the launch of the multi-probe, actually, Pioneer Venus 2. It was an Atlas Centaur rocket, and this is the very last U.S. planetary mission that will ever be launched by an expendable rocket. That is, one that you use for only that one mission and throw away. Hereafter, all of our space mission, all of our planetary missions, and all of our space missions, too, in a few years, but our next planetary mission, and all the ones after that, will be launched by reusable vehicles, namely the space shuttle. And the first one of those will be Galileo, which is rather like the Pioneer Venus multiprobe, except that it goes to Jupiter and has only one probe. But it consists of an orbiter and a probe. So it's rather like Pioneer Venus, I should say, put together. An orbiter and a probe mission. Until very recently, the picture was we were going to launch Galileo, both spacecraft together in 1982 from the space shuttle. That is simply not going to be possible. The shuttle is not going to be ready in time. This is a major crisis for Galileo. Probably the way it will be resolved is by having 2 separate launches as much as 2 years later. It turns out you can get away with that. As the name implies, the orbiter went to Venus and went into orbit around it in December 1978, and then 4 days later, the multi-probe arrived, having separated, where it says probe release sequence there. By the way, the 2 spacecraft were launched several months apart and arrived only, did I say 4 days? I'm sorry, 5 days, December 4th and December 9th. Respectively, arrived only 5 days apart, and the reason was it was easier on the launch crew to do it that way. That way they only had one mission at a time to worry about, and so the orbiter was placed into an orbit which intentionally wasted time and went out beyond the orbit of the Earth and cut in the orbit of the Earth practically at the point where the Earth was when the probes were launched, and thereafter they just chased each other to Venus. Well, starting 24 days out from the planet, the main part of the multi-probe spacecraft, which is called the bus, and that's exactly what it was. It was a vehicle to get the others to Venus and take care of them away. Starting 24 days out, it began to release the probes. The probes then entered the atmosphere of Venus. The bus did too. It did not have a heat shield. It was not designed to survive the entry, but before it burned up, it sent back some data on the way down, so it wasn't entirely a bus. It had a couple of instruments of its own. The main thing, though, was the probe. Here is the orbit of the orbiter, and I'm going to point out, you can see it's a very non-circular orbit, it's going in that direction, but I want to point out one thing about it, and that is that even in this higher scale view, the ARIA simply has not been able to show how the separation between the orbit and the surface of Venus, so close to the surface it goes. The orbiter is the first planetary spacecraft in history actually to dip into the upper atmosphere of the planet every time it goes around and make direct sample measurements. And that is an exceedingly tricky thing to have done, especially since the crucial firing of the rocket motor that put the orbiter in orbit around Venus had to take place behind Venus as seen from the Earth. So we did not even know on the Earth what was happening, let alone be able to do anything about it if something went wrong. And that was a life or death maneuver for the entire mission. And such a rocket had never before been fired after 5 months of inert storage in space. The record before that was about 2 days. Well, I wouldn't be giving this lecture this way if it hadn't worked. So you know it did. But it's just one of the many remarkable things about this mission that we're not recording. Here is an artist's conception with a lot of artistic license in it of the probe release. Actually, the large probe there in the center was released 4 days before the small probe, and they were released 15 million miles, is that right? No, 8 million miles, 15 million kilometers, and 24 days out from Venus, so of course the planet didn't look anything like that big. But the probes were released, and they entered the atmosphere, and during a period of slightly more than 1 hour on December 9th, 1978, they descended through the atmosphere of Venus and sent back data. They were not designed to survive the landing, and that seemed to cause endless confusion on the part of just about everybody, certainly including the reporters. They just could not understand what was going on. You know, why go all the way to Venus and not survive the landing? Answer, this was an atmospheric mission, the first one in history. It was not designed to survive the landing for the simple reason that it didn't have landing instruments. It didn't have cameras, it didn't have seismographs, it didn't have all that sort of thing. What it had was nothing but instruments to study what the atmosphere was made of, how much sunlight was getting down to different levels, what the structure of the clouds was, everything having to do with the atmosphere. The point of having four probes is this. The large probe had the majority of the instruments. There were seven different instruments on the large probe. And, for example, the only atmospheric composition instruments were on the large probe. It landed at a place that the scientists thought was most interesting, on the equator, as far around on the day side as possible. And you see, the probes transmitted directly to the Earth. They did not relay through either the orbiter or the bus. And there were various reasons that had to do with the history of the project more than anything else. There was a time when we thought there were going to be many more of these spacecraft and they would be launched in different years. When it became obvious there would be only two of them, the obvious thing to do was launch them together. But by then, the design was so far along that they couldn't make radical changes like let's use the orbiter to relay. So this was the view of Venus as seen from Earth on the day of probe entry. And so you see, you couldn't land further around on the day side. You couldn't land in the eye of Venus, for example, because you would have been out of sight of Earth. So the scientists felt that as far around on the day side as possible and on the equator was the most interesting point. But the large probe instruments were designed to measure those characteristics of the atmosphere of Venus that weren't expected to vary from place to place. For example, what it was made of. Okay, you got winds, we know you got winds, you got circulation in the atmosphere, it's going to mix it together. Planetary atmospheres simply do not vary in composition from place to place in ways that are terribly significant. Oh, there's an exception to that. The humidity on the Earth varies, but, you know, we know how to take care of that sort of thing. The small probes were intended to measure those characteristics of the atmosphere that might vary from place to place, and those were temperature, pressure, structure of the clouds, and how much sunlight gets into various levels, which might have varied if the cloud structure varied. So, well, why would it vary? Well, it might vary from day to night, right? It also might vary with latitude, that is, from equator to pole. So what you want to do to get the day-night variation is to land two of them, or send two of them in at the same latitude, and this one should be drawn further from the equator, with just about the same latitude, about 30 degrees south. One of them on the day side, and that was called the day probe, the other on the night side, that was called the night probe. And then send the third one in as far from the equator as possible, and so that one was called the north probe. You could have turned the triangle around and made it day probe, night probe, south probe, but they decided to do it this way. There's no particular reason. The equator didn't really bulge the season with quite as much as you showed in this drawing. So you had the large probe or founder probe, the day probe, the night probe, and the north probe, and the bus and the orbiter. And those are the six Pioneer Venus spacecraft. Now you know the cast of ballast. Actually, the North Probe was even luckier than we expected, because it went in right in the middle of the polar ring. And they were hoping for that, but they weren't really believing it happened. A remarkable thing happened. Although one of the probes was designed to survive the landing, the Day Probe actually did, and transmitted data from the surface of Venus. Now remember, it has no protection from temperature, practically no protection from the pressure. It nevertheless transmitted data from the surface of Venus for 67 minutes, and that is longer than several of the Russian landers, which were designed to survive on the surface. The record for survival on the surface of Venus is now held by the Mir 12, and that was 2 hours and 12 minutes, if I remember correctly. And please understand, that's an incredible achievement. You know, people tend to sneer at that when they don't know about what it's like on Venus, because they say, well, gee, our Viking landers are still alive and well, and they landed more than 3 years ago. Yeah, but that was on Mars. Mars is a pussycat. This is Venus, 900 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, hot enough to melt lead. And in fact, the Day Probe finally died only when the internal temperature that was affecting its instruments, which were never designed to survive this in the first place, reached nearly the boiling point of water. This came as an incredible coincidence, too. It was done long before the mission by a space artist named Don Dixon, and he painted the Day Probe. I mean, it's not just a small probe, it's the Day Probe. That was the only one that landed where it was sunlight. So, the only thing that was wrong was that, in reality, it landed on the side of the cone, so it should be tilted over more. Otherwise, all the pictures, you know, as far as we can tell, that's right. I mean, obviously, we don't know what that landscape looks like, but, you know, you got it right. It's really a remarkable coincidence. It's not more than that. Okay, the bus burned up, and it actually managed to penetrate 5 miles further into the atmosphere than it was supposed to. And those are crucial 5 miles. There's some very major changes happening in the atmosphere in that region. And as a result, we got some measurements that we did not get from any of the other spacecraft. So good old bus, the Cinderella of the mission, actually turned out to be a lot more useful than it should have. This is another Don Dixon painting. I guarantee the top of the clouds don't look like that. He tends to take an awful lot of artistic license. I don't know how much an artistic license costs in California, but... The orbiter is still orbiting and still sending back data, and I will show you early pictures and I will show you later pictures. I think that's my last... Oh yeah, this is just to tell you how much it costs. It costs 15 cents. It cost you 15 cents a year, though. It was the cheapest planetary mission we've ever flown. It was $175 million spread over 5 fiscal years, and for U.S. citizens, that worked out to about 15 cents per year, and that is less than 1/20th of what we spent on chewing gum. Last year happens to have been a historic year in that it was the first time that the United States spent more money on discotheques than on NASA. And that's the entire NASA budget. Here we're talking about one project. We spent $800 million a year on chewing gum. Of course, actually, it didn't cost that. It didn't cost anything. We get all our money back many times over on these projects. But if you want to know just how much it cost and not what the profit was, that's it, 15 cents a year. Okay, that is a good place to stop for the time being. Next week, we will finish up Venus. Yeah, well, I'll tell you as much more about Venus as we have time for. And probably the succeeding lectures will be third week, one on Jupiter, fourth week, one on the moons of Jupiter, and fifth week, the Pioneer Saturn results. Thank you very much. If you have questions, we can hang around for about 10 minutes more, but they tell me they want us all out of there, and the door's locked by 10 p.m. And thanks a lot. You think I talked a lot tonight? Well, you hear me or I don't have a cold next week. Let's give the people... I'm giving a lecture tomorrow from 7:30 to 10:30. It'll take me about an hour to drive home. Could I call you the following day? Could I call you Friday? When do you need the data? By Friday. Let's just hope you can get me... I'm going to leave for Oakland... somewhere around 3:30. It's going to be tight. I'm sorry. It's a doggone cold of mine. I'm planning to sleep until at least 2, you know, because I have got to... my throat has got to recover from this. It's a three-hour lecture tomorrow night. I've got to give it, you know. All I can say is I'll do my best for you. If I can't do it, I apologize.
I like
that. Oh, you caught it? Yeah, you actually caught it?
Yeah.
Oh, that was while I was away in California. Okay, that's no longer a problem. Now I go through it several times every day. I'm sorry, I'm supposed to be over here.
It's hilarious between the sizes of the mass of the Earth and Venus.
Yeah.
Is the difference in atmospheric pressure and density, specifically due to chemical makeup of the atmosphere, the CO2 versus...
Yeah, yeah. See, their CO2 is a gas. Ours is part of the rock. That's all. And the bulk properties of the planets are pretty much the same, with the exception of that glaring difference in water and the subtle but still very significant difference in primeval noble gases.
It just seems odd.
But really, we've got the same atmosphere they do, aside from those differences.
You mentioned the ambient pressure surface is quite a bit greater.
Yeah, it's 100 times ours because of all that CO2.
See?
Yeah. I'll tell you what, you heat the temperature of the Earth above the boiling point of water, and immediately you will have 300 Earth atmospheres of water vapor, because that's the oceans evaporating, and very shortly afterwards, 100 Earth atmospheres of carbon dioxide, because that heat will decompose the carbonate, decompose the limestone, and we'll be Venus. Or we will be Venus plus water. We'll have Venus, and that'll happen in about 2 billion years. Stick around. Be neat to see.
You mentioned the difference in the data return by the mass chromatograph and the mass spectrometer and the mass chromatograph. What do they do? Forget about the difference?
No. Okay, I don't understand the details because I don't really understand how a gas chromatograph works. I know how a mass spectrometer works, you know, probably in enough detail to be able to do it. I don't know how a GC works. I never bothered to find out. All I can tell you is... But there are reasons for that. I mean, you can adjust the data from the mass spec now that you know how to play with it so that it agrees with the GC data, okay? But to everybody's amazement, it's the GC that was the more reliable in the raw data.
How does the neutral mass spectrometer?
No time. Okay, you send your ions through, you ionize the atoms, if they're not ionized already, you send them through a magnetic field in such a way as they curve. The heavier they are, the less they curve. It is a neutral mass spectrometer because it works on the neutrals, but it ionizes them once they're inside. Oakland, it's right there. Oh, I'm sorry, it's hidden, it's under elsewhere. Solar eclipse, didn't go. Lunar eclipse, didn't go. I was in California for Pioneer Saturn. It was visible there, but... Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, the main message of that, this is the first feedback I've gotten from that radio piece, by the way. Thank you very much. This is the first time I heard that anybody...
Great.
That's what I was worried about. I sent that out as a press release, too, and I don't know if any of the print media picked it up. I don't think they did. I sure haven't heard. But you're the first person I've heard that used that. And, you see, the problem was that they scheduled the main summary press conference for Pioneer Saturn that morning. And I just had to make a priority decision. I knew that if I got up for the eclipse, I would get so excited I wouldn't even be able to get back to sleep. I'd have had about 2 hours of sleep, and I knew it was going to go on for hour after hour, and that I had to be alert through the whole thing. So the eclipse lost. And, of course, I've seen many lunar eclipses. I photographed them in the past, and so same thing with the solar. You know, I would have gone if I hadn't been to three already. But it was a matter of interfering with Voyager 1. They schedule these eclipses very inconveniently for me. Okay, we can take about two more questions, I think, and then we got to get out of here. All right, I got two more questions. It's an atmospheric thing because it appears over whatever place is directly under the sun at any given moment. And since the planet does rotate relative to the sun, that's not a fixed geographic location. A lot of people kind of suspected before we found out the answer, which was from radar data about 10 or 12 years ago, that Venus always faced the same side toward the sun the way the moon does toward the Earth. But not so. So, atmospheric.
Okay.